Well, I'm a little bit nervous because having been made welcome, I have to start with an apology. I don't like to, but I have to because you've come on the promise of a talk about crisis and struggle in Asia today, you know, and I had hopes to sort of report to you about all the struggles going on in the continent of Asia. But the kind of extension I needed on my credit card was turned down. Had I managed the sort of talk that I would have needed to do, would have had to have been on kind of Fidel Castro-style proportions, you know, lasting 8 hours, none of you being able to leave, you know, having to sort of cheer at particular moments. The cheering's still expected, I should point out. Thank you. But what I'm going to do instead, in all seriousness, what I'm going to do instead is narrow down to one struggle in 1 year of one country. That's a bit of a change. Partly that's the reason of time. The other reason, though, is there has been, you know, a number of struggles going on in Asia in the last 2 years. Massive incidents, as they're called in China, that you can read up about in the China Labour Bulletin. You know, massive struggles going on in Thailand for the direction of that country and a working-class pro-democracy movement. You can read about that on the Socialist Alternative website. What I want to do here is talk to you about a struggle that really got almost no coverage in the mainstream media, in the English-speaking world, and really went under the radar of a lot of the left press as well. And that's the candlelight movement in Korea, in the so-called South Korea. This struggle is particularly important for us in Australia, I think, for a number of reasons. Partly it happened, you know, we're in what's the so-called Western world when we're about as far east as you can go. You know, there's something strange there, yeah? We're internationalists. We should know about the struggles happening in our region. So just to educate you, it's important. It's important as well, though, I also think, because it's a struggle that happened in a developed country, in a country where a lot of, you know, the Labour government, the intellectuals sort of around Kevin Rudd are arguing Australia needs to emulate, yeah? That South Korea is this model of productivity that Australia needs to follow. So finding out how we fight, how they fought back against their lot can give us some hints how you might want to fight back against your lot. So that's the apology out of the way. The next bit, shorter and a bit more serious, I want to, before I go into the talk, pay tribute to the fact that a lot of the information in this talk is based on interviews I've conducted with activists in the Korean Peninsula, in South Korea, who've been involved in the movement, and just as of necessity, for most of them, their contribution is going to have to be anonymous. You know, so this talk is drawing on the wisdom and experience and courage of, you know, a number of activists who threw themselves into this movement that just for simple reasons of safety I'm not able to name. And so any kind of wisdom or insight that you get from the talk, you have to remember, has come from a range of people putting themselves out in that struggle. And we couldn't get that information if they hadn't had the courage to do that. Okay, there's a quote I've always liked. You know, you've heard a lot about crisis this weekend. And Walter Benjamin once said, the famous Jewish-German Marxist, once said, the crisis is that everything keeps going on as before, you know? The crisis is that everything keeps going on as before, that we live in a system as foul as this one, under the profit system, under the system of empire, under the system of war, you know? Normally when you talk about a crisis, it's something that's resolved, you know? If I was to stand up here and say, my marriage is in crisis, you know, you'd assume it's either going to end or, you know, there's counselling or whatever. The point is, everyday life under the capitalist system for vast numbers of people is crisis. Capitalism is crisis. You know, the global financial meltdown had a huge impact on the Northeast Asian economies, apart from China. Economies which had already experienced their own devastating collapse at the end of the 1990s. But also, I think all through this, normal life, in inverted commas, is distorted by US imperialism in Korea. Everyday life, just being an ordinary human being. Not only are many thousand soldiers, tens of thousands of soldiers, stationed in South Korea, you see them everywhere, but it's important for us to remember that this is a country still at war, you know, and one where a majority of its citizens don't want it to be. You know, the Korean War has never ended. The division of the Korean Peninsula is still a reality. Families still don't know, you know, you still don't know if your sister is alive or dead. You've never seen your grandchildren, this kind of thing. For most ordinary citizens, and poll after poll confirms this, the Cold War's over, you know. You stop a Korean person in the street, what they want, peace, reunification, you know, a chance for everyday, ordinary life to continue. But, of course, in the Korean Peninsula, the Cold War's never ended. The threat of war remains, you know, the potential for a city the size of Seoul to be obliterated due to US warmongering is very much the case. So the crisis and struggle of this talk's title has been going on against that background for a long time. The crisis part of the equation is obvious enough. You know, a divided peninsula, the threat of war, you know, economic situations, all of these sorts of things. The struggle part is an ongoing part as well, and I think this is very important. Korea's had only a little more than two decades of even very limited liberal democratic regimes. You know, until very, very recently, this was a country run by generals. There's been civilian rule since 1993, but successive governments, you know, overwhelmingly small L liberal governments that have been elected have attempted to push through neoliberal reforms. They haven't been as successful in Korea as they have been in some other parts of the world. I think if people want a comparison with Europe, the best example would be France. You know, a country where the ruling class hasn't given up and they've been chipping away, but there's been movements that have slowed them down and held them back. So the ruling class are clear that this is a crisis too. And it's a crisis to shape the long-term future of the Korean Peninsula. Here's the one thing you're going to remember from this talk in 2 weeks. A quote from the Prime Minister Hun. And he said, "The government intends to counter illegal strikes and violent demonstrations that could have negative effects on the nation's economy." This is the punchline, this bit. "To reach the level of an advanced nation, it's necessary to correct the backwardness of our demonstration culture." Now, isn't that fantastic? Imagine living somewhere where the Prime Minister says, "What have you got? You know, well, you know, we AFL, and, you know, meat pies, this kind of stuff. What have you got? Oh, a demonstration culture? That's part of our culture. We go and protest." Right, this is seen as something in the ruling class that needs to be smashed, yeah? There's an expectation amongst the Korean workers, you go on demonstrations. Demonstrations are a part of everyday life. The current period, the period that, you know, we're in at the moment, 2010, is one of standoff and stalemate. The government's got the edge, right? We have to say this. The government has the edge. They've survived a round of serious threats to their authority and they're still intact, right? So our side is on the back foot. But, you know, we're backwards, we're not down, right? There's still something of a standoff going on. There's talk at the moment, you know, as of the last couple of months, of banning all demonstrations in public areas. So in the next couple of months, there'll be a serious showdown in Korea about public rights, democratic rights. Force and repression have once again managed to beat down opposition, but the government, for now, is still unable to resolve the underlying causes of revolt and crisis and struggle. So in this talk, I'm going to try and give a picture of one part of that struggle, which is the candlelight movement, which emerged from May to August of 2008. The candlelight movement offers us a lot to reflect on, as I'm going to show for activists in this part of the country. Those of you that want to read more about other parts of Asia, I've recommended some of the sites, and also Kay Broadbent, who's a member of Social Alternative, has produced work on the union struggles in Japan. So if you want to read more widely, I'd recommend her work. The other reason is, I was there. Yeah, it's an eyewitness account. In 2008, I travelled with another a socialist of Korean background, Shomi Yoon, who spoke at a conference very much like this one at Seoul University. And she spoke at that event. I was, you know, a witness to that. And we both were taken to a number of demonstrations and movement meetings, so I can report from there. Humility doesn't come naturally to me, so I've written this bit down. I have to say I promised you a first-hand account, but I need to stress it's the first-hand account of a spectator, an eyewitness, not a participant, not a leader, not an activist. I talked about the insights of the talk and how I owe those to others, but I also have to point out that what we witnessed was spectacular repression and spectacular risks and bravery others took that we didn't take. So when I say an eyewitness, I think it's important to distance myself from some of the bravery I'm going to recount in this talk. Okay, so 2008. The year started very inauspiciously for Korean workers. Korean workers were disgruntled and dismayed at the betrayals of the mainstream left-wing parties. Having elected neoliberal candidates through the 1990s, voters had then had to see neoliberal reforms implemented. From 1997 to 2002, Kim Dae-jung, who was a liberal reformist president with a movement passed, made more neoliberal reforms. You know, he'd undergone serious repression as a young person in the 1980s, became president, he moved against the movements that had elected him. There were, in 2002, mass anger at the US murder of children, something that happens reasonably commonly in Korea, yeah? Soldiers get drunk, run over a child, yeah? Rape and murder a teenager, and then get sent home. No legal redress for this. No chance for Korean people to appeal to justice. Mass demonstrations against this under Kim Dae-jung. 2002, Roh Moo-hyun, another ex-movement president, was elected again from the left and then took Korea into the Iraq War and failed to abolish the security law. The security law, which is still on the books, I have to point out, can see you sent to jail for owning, distributing, or having access to basically anything that we have up in our bookstore. I met people, a number of you may have read Alex Kalinikos' Revolutionary Ideas of Karl Marx. Yeah? You know, you've seen it around. I met people in Korea that did jail time, I mean years of jail time, for selling that book, for having it available, a book that's on university courses the world over. So in this context, Lee Myung-bak's victory in December of 2007, presidential elections, felt for many in the union and the movements like a sign that society had moved to the right. Yeah, think back to when Howard won the 2004 election. There was widespread demoralization amongst the mass of the left. You know, Lee Myung-bak is famous in Korea for, he's called the bulldozer. Yeah, this idea, I'm the destroyer, I get stuff done. You know, comes from a business background. He's in a major company, got elected on this platform of, right, I'm going to bulldoze through this demonstration culture. Yeah, and so the conclusion of vast swathes of the left was, this is a sign society's moved to the right. You know, it's awful. This awful man's been elected. It's absolutely terrible. We're going to face a period of demoralization and decay amongst the movements. And this may sound familiar to some of you, very small groups of socialists stood against this, saying that the election did not represent a turn to the right, but rather demoralisation with so-called left-wing candidates that had betrayed their supporters. Lee Myung-bak made all sorts of wild promises in the course of his campaigning, like really, you know, wild promises. Koreans love numbers for some reason, and his promise was 747. 7% growth, a $40,000 US dollar GDP per capita and the world's seventh largest economy. You know, I mean, pluck them out of a hat. Yeah. Part of his appeal to the ruling class was the idea that he'd get stuff done. Yeah, that he'd smash up the movements that needed smashing up. Okay, so that happens. Everyone's very depressed, apart from very small groups of socialists. The outlook looks fairly dreary. 19th of April, he flies to the US and signs a deal with Bush. Remember him? To open up Korea for imports of US beef. And there are serious concerns about the safety of US beef and the danger of mad cow disease. Really serious safety concerns here. What happens next, and I think this is very important for Australia, what happens next isn't actually picked up on by the organised left or the union movement for about a month. Online petitions start circling amongst high school students. You know, the Korean equivalent of Facebook, a number of social networking sites, these sorts of things. Begin to circulate a petition against the free trade agreement with the United States, initiated by high school students, that quickly gets over a million signatures to it. And the kind of the, what do the young people call them, the chat rooms and then the discussion sites where this petition is being signed begin to become forums for discussions about all aspects of the society, the education system, the incredibly harsh regime of exams, all sorts of things, okay? You know, just imagine that going on in a kind of subterranean way. You know, one day our teenagers are, you know, exchanging tokens in mafia wars or something. The next day they're signing a petition against the free trade agreement, right? Not noticed by the left, you know? In the newspapers, in the public meetings, demoralization continues. Now, something very, very interesting happens here. The question of food safety comes from the petition to begin to go into all sorts of seemingly non-left-wing forums. Daytime talk chat shows, you know, lifestyle columns in Sunday newspapers, very, very odd places, apolitical places. And yet, everywhere it appears, it quickly sparks discussions about a whole range of other questions. About the government's environmental plans and a canal plan I don't have time to talk about. About the free trade agreement and the presence of the US on the Korean Peninsula more generally. About young people's quality of life. One of the big slogans of the movement, I think this is really sad and really beautiful at the same time. One of the big slogans of the movement becomes, let's sleep a little, let's eat a little, which is an expression of students' exhaustion in the face of an exam system which just grinds them to make them ready for, you know, a working life that's going to grind them down. And suddenly, at a quite opportune moment, and this is really a question of luck, socialists, organized socialists in the Korean group all together, Tae Humke, which has politics in the tradition of socialist alternative, managed to appear on one of these daytime television talk shows. A doctor, a medical doctor who's a socialist, and a young woman who the media go on to call the Candle Girl, who is a student leader of theirs, managed to get tickets to the show as if by luck. Both of them used the show as a platform to denounce the government, to call for action, to connect a whole series of things that have been going on in the online forums with the media. All of a sudden, and this is one of these moments where it seems spontaneous, you know, within a few days, there have been hundreds of demonstrations on the streets of Korea. Like this one. And I want to start with a quote here from a leader of Altogether, Kim Kwang-il. And he says, in early May, this anger and sense of crisis exploded into the open in the candlelight demonstrations. On the first day, the sight of 20,000 people filling the streets was a real shock. On that day, everyone was surprised at the scale and the confidence of that demonstration. The internet-based groups that had called the demo, the participants themselves, and the police. You know, so the internet-based groups called a demo expecting a couple hundred people, 20,000 show up, you know. Between the 2nd and the 23rd of May, right, about 3 weeks, there are rallies in the central square in Seoul every day. Every day there are these mass rallies where people are in the center, they're not yet confident to march, okay? The people that are organizing these rallies are not from the organized left initially. They don't have traditions. They organize a candlelight demonstration, they stay in the square. Remember, this is a society where the police have enormous powers and have used incredible violence really at the drop of a hat, right? Have killed people. So to be in the square, not having come from a political background, is an act of enormous courage, and just keep coming to the square. Then, again, seemingly spontaneously, something happens. They begin to march. They begin to leave the square. The mass protests in the spring, like I said, catch everyone by surprise. And it's important to say the police, for the moment, being caught unaware, are paralysed. And that's important for giving the movement breathing space to begin to emerge. But the left, the large forces of the left, you know, the Democratic Labour Party, these forces are passive as well. And that gives an opening to smaller groups. That gives an opening to socialists. In these weeks, a whole new generation discovers activism and starts to question and debate politics. And I want to read some quotes. Again, this is a quote that's going to have to remain anonymous. This is from a female comrade in Altogether. And she told me, I was struck by how different it felt to Korean demos before. There was a real sense of creativity, people doing their own thing, making funny banners, doing demo performance art, lots of humour, and that general sense of people feeling their own power and owning the streets. There was also an amazing feeling when people began marching rather than just sitting holding candles. The march roved around downtown Seoul, wherever it felt like, and completely left the riot police behind, guarding Gwanghwamun. Basically, I felt an excitement on the streets I'd never felt before. Yeah. Now look at this. Notice the imagery. I want to show you a few things here. These two, the candlelight girl and the candlelight boy, become the image of the demonstration, right? And I want you to notice something about the imagery of these photographs. Many of you, I think, will be familiar with imagery of Korean demonstrations in the past, yeah? And if you were to sort of name a few things that come to mind, it's sticks, armour, yeah, big physical confrontations with the police, set piece battles, these sorts of things, right? There are historical reasons for that kind of level of militarization of the movement, yeah, an extremely repressive social formation. And I don't want to downplay the heroism of the union militants that do those battles, but it's promoted political problems within the movement, you know, that degree of militarization. There's a certain theatricalization of street protest in Korea from time to time, where the union leadership will send their members out into set-piece battles with the police that don't really have a strategy, don't really head anywhere. And there's also, it makes it extremely hard for the workers' movement to connect with younger workers and often with women workers. Yeah, it's a very macho world. You know, it's very hard to imagine people being able to come into it. The candlelight movement's imagery, its self-presentation, shows that it breaks with the past. Yeah, it breaks with the traditions of the Korean movement and some of its worst traditions. It's no less militant. This isn't a question of street theater versus strikes. And people are showing enormous courage defying the law to protest. Yeah, they're still showing that dedication. But they're doing it in a different, more participatory way. They're doing it in a movement that isn't controlled from the top by the union bureaucracy and the reformists. Okay. Right, it's going to be the edited version from here on. This demonstration here, June 10, up to 1 million from all walks of life participate in the candlelight protests. And this is held on the 21st anniversary of a pro-democracy rising in Seoul. So it's redolent with symbolism. Meanwhile, the nation's riot police had mobilized its largest force ever in preparation for the events to come. And I'm going to quote from a left nationalist newspaper, the Hankyore, where they say the main event, a candlelight march, estimated by the organizers to have been attended by up to 1 million. Protesters at this march were demanding that the government renegotiate the US beef agreement and called on President Lee Myung-bak to resign. Right? So a month after having begun candlelight vigils purely about the question of beef and safety of food, the movement suddenly, as its main target, calling for the president to resign, to overthrow the right-wing government. In hindsight, and this wasn't clear to me when I was in Korea, in hindsight, this was the climax of the movement. It needed to deepen its aims, it needed to connect with the working class, it needed to have a debate about political strategy, leadership, the question of the state. Those debates were had in meeting rooms this size. They weren't had in mass meetings of hundreds and thousands. You know, stalemate set in. Strategic questions, or the question of strategy itself, and I'll come back to that in a second, could no longer be avoided. The candlelight movement has pretty much commandeered central Seoul for the best part of a month. Yeah, the movement runs the streets. The movement has shut down the streets. What are you going to do next? What's going to happen next? What's your demand going to be next? So what next? Organised socialists, again, particularly all together, argue for that the movement needs to press forward, to call for the government to step down, to aim at the president himself. Others, and I think this is a legacy of the anti-capitalist movement that's very important, others oppose politics coming into the movement and press for its spontaneous nature being maintained. At times, these political clashes between socialists and autonomists and others who insist on maintaining the spontaneity of the movement become physical clashes. And there are a number of times during the movement when socialists and unionists had won a democratic debate for the vigils to turn into marches and to march on political targets when they were physically blockaded by autonomous forces, by forces arguing for spontaneity. They'd surround trucks to prevent them from leaving. I don't know how spontaneous it is if you decide something and then someone stops you doing it, you know. I'll have to leave that for the discussion, perhaps. Also, and this is something that's more significant in the oppressed world than in a country like Australia, but I think does come up, is having been absent at the beginning, NGOs now begin to dominate the leadership and the organisation of the movement. They play a contradictory role, sometimes pushing things forward. Yeah, at one stage, the YMCA argued for civil disobedience, which I think is kind of nice. You know, sometimes they keep things within the bounds they're comfortable with. You know, but crucially, they have the bureaucracy there and the resources to depoliticise the movement at key moments. Most importantly, though, the movement needs to organise the organised working class, needs to involve the organised working class. Unions have been on the demonstrations from the beginning, but they're only just beginning to play an active role by the time the movement's gone into decline. There have been two-hour solidarity strikes that socialists managed to win within the unions. Can more be done? You know, we win a two-hour kind of symbolic strike. Could there have been a general strike? And there's reasons for that that I'm going to have to skip over due to time that could come up in the discussion. These photographs here, I just want to give you a sense. If you look at these, I took these photographs wandering around central Seoul in the evening when there was no demonstration happening. What the movement had done is it had put banners up. It's summer, right, so it's very warm. It's lovely to walk around the street. It's very humid. You know, it's nice to walk around the streets. And what you can do is little groups of activists in these areas, because it's hard, you can't have public meetings very easily in Korea, the government's much more repressive, having the banners there, getting people to sign the banners, then begins discussions. Yeah? So on every street corner, there was a spontaneous political meeting happening. On every street corner, there was a banner gathering young people around it to talk about where the movement needed to go. Incredibly inspirational stuff. Okay. It can't go on like this, can it? You know the talk's going to pick up. The government regains initiative. Yeah? On the 14th of June, all the members of the National Police Agency's Human Rights Board resigned in protest at the way the demonstrations had been dealt with. We don't know why they resigned, but that may well mean there were mass assaults going on in smaller centres. Yeah? Repression beginning outside of Seoul in the smaller centres where the right felt more confident. On the 18th, the President issues a public apology, saying he should have handled the demonstrations better. At the time, we thought that was a sign that we were beginning to win. You know, at the time, we thought that the apology was a sign of things to come. With hindsight, the apology was him putting a line in the sand. This is as far as he'd go, they were going to begin to push back. On the 28th of June, 100,000 march and a candlelight vigil. Police attacked the rally and over 300 are arrested. This is where the YMCA, you know, had their finest hour. From June, again, these are some portraits of when the movement was at its strongest, where the police had tried to block the movement into parts of Seoul, so the movement was big enough it could surround the blockade and then blockade the blockaders. Someone labelled this photograph, "If you park illegally, you will be towed." So, in June, a member of All Together, Kim Kwang-il, and other leaders barricade themselves in a Buddhist temple in downtown Seoul after arrest warrants are issued for them. They continue to lead from within the barricaded area for some months after this. Yeah? The police cannot get in, and they continue to go on. The rally... Oh, I'll come back to that. There's a rally on the 15th of August. This is the one that I witness, which is a very important day in Korean history, Liberation Day. This is the rally where the police show decisively they have the upper hand and the demonstration is routed. I've got some photographs to come back. What I mean is they mobilise the army, all of central Seoul is occupied, anyone that appears on the streets is either beaten or sprayed with coloured water so their clothes will be stained, which means when they're attempting to escape, they can then be hunted down and beaten individually. And the demonstration simply is overwhelmed physically. This is how the back of the movement's broken. Politically, then, the pressure begins to ramp up. On the 27th of August, an anti-Stalinist economist, O.C. Chol, is arrested under the security laws. Ultra-rightist groups start to be given a free rein to attack demonstrations. So where in the earlier weeks of the movement, it had been a joyous, festival-like atmosphere on the streets, it kind of the oppressed, in the high summer, the aim is to maintain a presence. Yeah? And these demonstrations are quite scary, you know, and intimidating. From June, the movement has been in a period of guerrilla activity as it winds down. You know, it's never decisively beaten, but it's, in the face of overwhelming police brutality, lost the initiative. You know? So what we have is one of these situations where a lot of the free trade agreements gutted. You know, the right-wing government is stalled. It still exists, but like Sarkozy in France, it's unable to continue with its program. But the movement has to back down as well. You know, the movement dissolves. Very much a stalemate situation. Okay, so I want to call this Seoul the war zone. We arrive in Seoul in early August for the second time. We've been to one of the demonstrations and we come back for the second time. One thing was clear, that the movement still had the imagination of the city. I've shown you those pictures. The other thing, though, of course, was that the police were now clearly prepared to use any measure of force to restore order. I don't know, those of you that have been to Seoul, the central area where a lot of the sort of historical buildings were, was lined with police, you know, I mean, lined thousands of army and police everywhere. You could not get in to particular areas. You couldn't move across the street. There were vans, trucks, all sorts of things everywhere, water cannons, day in, day out, just to make you frightened, to feel you're in an occupied city. The political momentum of the campaign had been lost, but what's crucial, and I think this is incredibly inspirational, a new generation had been politicised by it. Over 1,000 people attended the Marxism conference in Seoul, a conference a lot like this one. The police efforts to prevent the conference taking place were extraordinary. This was the height of summer in Korea, you know, so it's over 30 degrees, there's, you know, 700% humidity, it's extremely unpleasant, and 6 hours before the conference started, all power was cut to the venue, you know, so they had to get generators for themselves. When you went to the opening rally, imagine this if you've never been to a political event before, or if you have and you're not a particularly courageous person, to get to the opening rally, you had to walk up a line of riot police, you know, who had surrounded the university and surrounded the entrance to intimidate and frighten young people. A thousand people still attended. That is a tribute, I think, to the politicization of this new generation. Look at some images of Marxism here, the candlelight movement obviously being attended to, but also banners that have been donated by trade unions, by the rank and file groups of trade unions who have been inspired by the courage and the mobilization of the socialists and the political clarity of the socialists. You know, these are all banners from major trade unions. This is the so-called candlelight girl, the leader, student leader who appeared on the talk show speaking at the opening rally. Here are the leaders speaking via Skype from their hold-up location, their undisclosed location in a Buddhist temple in central Seoul. And again, bear in mind, that's a triumph, being able to have this happen, because again, you're clearly defying the police laws. Holding a public meeting with a fugitive speaking is another sign of where the movement hasn't won, but it's opened a democratic space that did not exist before it attempted what it attempted. Another leader here. This was the main movement that came through. And just quickly, because I'm running out of time, these are the demonstrations being defeated. These are the attacks on the demonstrations here. It may not look like much, but if you bear in mind that this is a high-pressure hose, people are having their bones broken. Okay, so, is this dying out without a whimper? You think, I came to a talk on crisis and struggle and all I got was this, you know, incomplete protest movement. I want to argue against that. It looks like a victory for Imon Buck, and in the short term it is. But the movement has brought itself breathing space. You know, the Grand National Party, the criminal of the Liberal Party's plans to privatise water are shelved due for fear of the candlelight movement. Right? They have a whole lot of plans that obviously in Kansas, in cabinet, the people said, don't do that, look what happened with the last thing. Yeah? So not so much has happened. It's also had the effect of forcing the government on the defensive. Imon Buck's approval ratings hover around 20%. So what next? There's been no business as usual last year either. There's two things that I've run out of time to discuss, but could be worth looking up further. One is in 2009, the suicide of the former President Roh, a reformist president, sparked more mass demonstrations in Korea, in Seoul in particular. So the candlelight movement has revived the protest culture. And most importantly, from July and August last year, the Sanyong workers occupy their factory against the threat of redundancies, and in the face of horrendous violence and repression, managed to stand firm and, you know, win something, not everything they wanted, but much more than they could have had they not done that. Again, the courage of the candlelight movement is a clear inspiration for those workers, and they reference it in their struggle. So, in some ways, nothing's changed. You know, the government's still on the offensive. The neoliberal program still exists. You know, repression still exists on a mass scale. The security laws are still there. The candlelight movement's changed none of that. What it has done, though, is worth noting. It's maintained the culture of protest. Think for a moment what countries where the workers' movement and the socialist left, with political clarity to carry the argument in the workers' movement, has been able to create with this culture. Think of France, think of Korea. At the very least, a tradition of taking to the streets can slow the ruling class down, yeah? Can throw a spoke in the wheel. Imon Buk got elected promising he'd be able to get things done, and he's done nothing. He's done nothing. He's been discredited. That's given us a chance to regain the ideological offensive. And of course, a culture of protest isn't the same as preferring kimchi to Vegemite, you know, sensible as that preference may be. It's a political question. The fact that all together have managed to build through political repression, through having to be underground, in and out of jail from 50 people in 1990 to well over 1,000 now is testimony to what clarity of ideas can give you. You know, what anti-Stalinist politics can give you in a country still divided according to the Cold War. I think that's very important, and maybe in the discussion, the summing up, we'll talk more about what their underground status means. And also, it's thrown up questions for us to ponder. And I want to finish with the response of two other participants when I asked them what legacies the movement left them to grapple with. One woman who's an organizer with Altogether said to me, the big question for her is, what is the role of leadership and spontaneity? Much like the anti-capitalist movement, the idea of the pure spontaneity and non-political nature of the movement became entrenched at certain points and caused major conflicts between those who wanted to keep the purity of the movement and those who wanted it to have some leadership and direction. In fact, this theme was taken up by the right-wing press, who began to complain about how the movement had lost its purity and was being taken over by hardened elements. Of course, they'd never supported the movement in the first place, she adds. And another leader, a student member of theirs, said this to me. His question is, what is the relationship between the radical left and NGOs in the social movements? Civil society groups played a major role in the movement. NGOs can play the sort of ambivalent but ultimately reformist role that social democratic parties have been playing in Europe. So socialists have to work out how to relate to them without being sectarian in upsurges like this through united fronts, but without allowing them to derail the movement. Now, those are questions that the Korean left is going to have to answer for itself. You know, we can't send answers on the back of a postcard from this conference. You are contributing, though. You are contributing. I want to end by stressing the importance of ideas and their concrete role. A movement like the Candlelight Movement won't happen here. You know, it's a different historical format, different society. We can't just repeat it word for word. But movements happen here, and thinking about strategy can help those movements. Modelling can help us. And it struck me through the conference we attended that the hunger of the Candlelight Movement generation, overwhelmingly teenagers, was for ideas and history that could help them make sense of their situation. There was nothing strange for that generation about sitting in a room talking about the Russian Revolution, talking about the anti-war movement in Britain, talking about economics. They wanted ideas. They've got a taste of their own power. So this peculiarly Korean experience and movement, in other words, hadn't sent them into an inward looking for answers. You know, they didn't want to hear only about Korean history. Rather, it had given them the confidence in internationalism, in the need for strategy and the chances for next time. They want to learn about other countries. An image to the end that stuck in my memory. The final conference, singing the Internationale, several hundred Korean young Koreans. Not triumphalist, you know. They'd all just had the shit kicked out of them by the riot police the night before. They'd lost, yeah, and their movement had been broken. Wasn't triumphalist, but it was serious. The look on the faces of the people in that conference made me know that one phase of the movement was coming to a close, but they were steadying themselves for what was to come next. It was a room full of determination and seriousness. The self-confidence and cool-headedness of that crowd of 1,000 or so made me think I was in a room of experienced militants. Later on, I learned that the average involvement in politics for a conference participant was less than 3 months. So I think Wordsworth's days of joy, when it is, you know, pure joy to be alive, are still happening today.